it's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate, and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast. Okay, thank you for tuning in once again to the It's Going Down podcast. We're joined today with Professor of History Peter Cole at the Western Illinois University. He is part of a group of people who have written a new book called Wobblies of the World, which takes a look at the international influence and history of the industrial workers of the world, the IWW or the Wobblies, on a global scale, which is something that, as far as I understand, has not been done in a book form. And today we're going to be talking about exactly that, about the influence in the history of the IWW globally in countries and continents from as far away as Africa to Asia, about the relationship between the IWW and other anarcho-syndicalist or syndicalist unions like the CNT, and a lot of different stuff. We've got a couple questions that people have sent us and that have replied to our tweets over Twitter, so let's just get into it. So do you want to just introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about the book?
Of course. My name is Peter Cole. I'm a professor at Western Illinois University and worked there for quite a while. Before I worked on this book, I actually wrote my first book, similar title, Wobblies on the Waterfront. I came up with both titles, haha. That book was about the dock workers in Philadelphia in the World War I era, which is the heyday of the IWW. And I studied that union, which was called Local 8, because it was, I argued, the most racially integrated union in the United States in that era. And so, as a result of that experience, I, became interested in and stayed interested in and studied the IWW. Along the way, of course, you meet fellow travelers, people with like interests, and two of those people are named Kenyon Zimmer and David Struthers. Kenyon's a professor of history in Texas at Arlington and near Dallas, and Dave teaches in Copenhagen in Denmark. They also did research for their dissertations and first books on anarchism, mostly in the United States and Mexico. And there's a lot of affinities among and sort of connections between anarchists and Wobblies in many places. And so the three of us developed the idea to try to create an anthology that would tell some of the international history of the IWW, because many people, myself included, had written about it in a specific city or country, essentially in isolation from the IWW's chapters and people in other countries and other parts of the world. And so there's a lot of reasons why no one has ever attempted an international history of the IWW. If only the most obvious are that it's really hard. I mean, to try to put together, given the sort of the extensive organizing of the IWW, the many countries that Wobblies traveled in, the many languages that Wobblies spoke and wrote in. And so this book is an anthology. That means it's a collection of chapters written by different people, many of whom are experts in different aspects of the IWW. And together, this is not a complete history by any means of the IWW worldwide, but it's a reasonable and respectable sampling of IWW organizing in many countries. The last point I'd make about that is that almost every chapter in our book is what increasingly is called transnational, meaning that the people, the ideas, the organization really moved across political boundaries between countries. And, you know, historians in particular, but humans in general, often think in national sort of states. But the Wobblies didn't respect those boundaries necessarily, had no reason to. You know, capitalism's global, and so the Wobblies imagine themselves as global. They name themselves the industrial workers of the world on purpose. And it's only now, perhaps, that scholars and others have caught up, if you will, and so that we can tell the story, or try to tell at least some of the stories of the IWW, through this international but also this transnational lens. And so that's the intention of the book, with, like I said, a sampling of chapters, close to 20, that explore different individuals and different groups of Wobblies in many parts of the world.
Awesome. Well, in the introduction to the book, you all talk about kind of centering anarchism and syndicalism and anarcho-syndicalism, and you say that it was the largest revolutionary current within the working class in the period before the rise of the Soviet Union. And I'm just curious if you can just kind of flesh that out for us, but also kind of locate the IWW within that. And I'm going to assume that most people realize that the IWW, or know that the IWW was a syndicalist union that was formed in the U.S. that was very militant, anti-capitalist, called for the abolition of the wage system on industrial lines, and was formed in 1905.
Well, that's a very good short summary, or a very good summary considering how short it was. I don't assume anything, and you know, and that's no in disrespect intended, right? Like, who the hell are the Wobblies, right? But even more so, what the hell is syndicalism? It's like a mouthful, and anarcho-syndicalism is even worse. And so, you know, in the mid-late 19th century, there's various different socialist currents. Peoples in Europe and the Americas and other parts of the world who are thinking about capitalism and critical of capitalism. And, you know, Karl Marx was far from alone. And so there was a lot of folks in the mid and late 19th century, especially in Europe, which was the most quick to industrialize and therefore essentially transition to capitalism. So it's not surprising that we see these essentially everywhere. The capitalism spreads, people start questioning it. But, you know, it was the first part of the world that it emerged. And so, you know, there's different currents, right? Different disagreements about organizing, how to organize. Or first, you organize through workplace, but also different intents, different goals. You know, what sort of society would you want to build? You could build a new society. The Wobbly said, if you're building a society, a new society within the ashes of the old. But like many socialist and other theoretical ideas, right? Sort of the devil's in the details. That sounds good, but what does that mean? The Wobblies and other unions like Wobblies, they rejected political solutions as the primary means to achieving a socialist world. They instead essentially believed that worker power was the key, that where ordinary people have power is on the job, and therefore that's where you can exert power, and that's where you've got to exert power. But by contrast, that the ballot box is not the place that workers will have nearly as much power. And that essentially other socialist traditions, including the Socialist Party of America, but later the Communist Party in the U.S., but the Communist parties around the world, had a very different vision that was saw a political party as the primary vehicle to achieving a socialist society, right? And so you might see these as the two, if we were to group, right, the two main traditions, right? One is sort of sees an economic path to freedom, and the other sees a political one, right? And that there are also then anarchists who are more individualistic, who might share much in common with Wobblies, but either aren't working class people or are suspicious of those sorts of groupings too. But, you know, so there's overlaps, plenty of overlaps between anarchists and Wobblies, but not all anarchists essentially believe that unions, workplace organizations, were the primary method of organizing. The Wobblies did. And like you said, in 1905, the IWW was born in 1905 in Chicago. But there are other similar organizations in many countries in Europe and in Latin America that are emerging in the early 20th century as well. Yeah.
Well, just to go back to the introduction, the intro writes, I just want to really hit on this. You kind of talked a little bit about this when we started, but the intro says, the IWW organized in supposedly impossible places like the American South, where white and black workers managed to overcome pervasive racism. Can you just talk a little bit about this? I mean, I feel like a lot of historians are maybe kind of like the few sentences that you would glean from your textbooks in high school that mention the IWW might talk about certain strikes. But I mean, this was a huge thing that, you know, the IWW mm-hmm. fought against not only this kind of racial division on the job, but also like stood up against groups like the KKK. Can you just talk a little bit about this mm-hmm. and why this was important in the history of the WOB, please?
Theoretically, all socialists see all workers as brothers and sisters and comrades, and therefore we're all on the same team. In reality, many people's racial, national, I'd add sex prejudices cloud their judgments. And so in a number of countries, including the United States, but also in Australia, in South Africa, in the UK, you had peoples who identified, self-identify as socialists in socialist organizations like the Socialist Party of America, yet nevertheless denied membership to people of color and or immigrants, or were suspicious of their abilities to essentially be full participants in the struggle. The Wobblies, by contrast, and the Wobblies are not alone, but the Wobblies were pretty principled in their anti-racism. And so the two best examples from IWW history in the USA are, as you mentioned, organizing of timber workers in Louisiana and Texas in the late 1900s, early 19-teens, where in virulently racist societies, communities, and workplaces, black white timber workers, in fact, overcame their own prejudice, but also that of their society, and organized into something called the Brotherhood of Timber Workers, which, not surprisingly, experienced tremendous repression pretty quickly. The second example is the one that I briefly mentioned was in Philadelphia, where a workforce that was one-third Irish and Irish-American, one-third European immigrant, and one-third African-American also overcame their ethnic, racial, and national differences in order to form the most powerful union that Waterfront had ever seen. Yeah, and so the Wobblies, from its inception, were anti-racist. It's the first article, the first section of the Constitution is that all workers, regardless of color or creed, are welcome. Although sometimes, you know, people in theory are good and practice are not. The Wobblies didn't organize African Americans all the country. It wasn't a high priority to target people of African descent, but in a number of workplaces where there were blacks, there are good examples of multiracial organizing in a time when that was almost unheard of.
Right. And you brought up another thing. You brought up repression. That was actually the next question, but can you just talk a little bit about just the massive repression that the IWW faced over its history? It's interesting because, you know, so many groups of Wobblies were engaged in what they called free speech fights. When you counterpose that today with free speech almost being something that's been recuperated by the far right, you know, like Milo's Free Speech Week or these so-called free speech rallies like Unite the Right in Charlottesville. Can you just talk a little bit about why the Wobblies went out to organize these free speech fights and also just the repression that they faced?
Yeah, well, I mean, we could talk for an hour or more about the repression of the IWW in the USA alone. So in ways large and small, communities and employers, rival unions, and in the American Federation of Labor, as well as the state, actively worked to undermine a union that was, you know, very overtly revolutionary in its intent. It's not entirely surprising when societies that are committed to X, you know, do all they can to put down Y. I mean, I don't support it, but I'm not shocked by it. In the case of the IWW, you know, early on, different cities, I mean, a lot of these working class people, you know, were migratory workers. They might live in a place for a few months at a time and find employment and then move on to another place. The economy actually really created such an economy so that workers of this sort were needed. You might work for a few months, say, in the forests then you might work for a few months in a city, maybe on the docks, then you might ship out and move to another place or hop a train and work, say, agricultural work, right? And so it was actually quite common. There were millions of people in the U.S. alone who essentially shifted from jobs to jobs seasonally or maybe a bit less frequently. And so how do you get these people, right? So the Wahhabis did what other groups did is they organized on the streets, right? They'd set up soap boxes, as they were called, basically just little milk crates, and they'd stand on them. So you're a little higher than the people passing by and you'd start to speak. And sometimes these soap boxers were very effective at creating more Wahhabis. And so some cities just banned street speakers in certain neighborhoods or of certain sorts, generally targeting the IWW. And so the Wahhabis famously said, screw that. Like, we're going to just engage in what later would be called civil disobedience. We're going to consciously break these laws we think are unjust. And so they would call for, in their newspapers, Wahhabis come to Spokane, Washington, one of the first great free speech fights. Let's just break the law together, fill up the jails, and force the city of Spokane to abandon their bans on public speaking. These are referred to generally as the free speech fights, as you said. And in one regard, you could say that, man, these people were really sort of fighting for the First Amendment. And that's not wrong. That wasn't their primary intent. Their primary intent wasn't to ensure the liberties of the Constitution of the United States. But they were mindful that they were being targeted and they were being discriminated against. And they were also mindful, in fact, that that violated national law. And so they worked to, overturn these, sometimes successfully, sometimes not successfully, in dozens of communities across really the American West and Canada in the 19-teens. The repression more generally of the IWW really sort of exists from its inception, but drastically expands when the United States goes to war in 1917 and 1918. One of many good reasons to be fearful of war is that states often use war as an excuse to sort of repress dissent, as well as people who disagree with the mainstream, right? And so in the case of the Wahhabis in the USA, World War I was essentially laws were passed by the U.S. Congress called espionage and sedition laws that were used against the IWW in 1917, 1918, and what was at that time the largest trial and the longest trial in U.S. history, in which approximately 100 Wahhabi leaders from around the country were tried en masse in Chicago, a trial that lasted over 4 months. And then the jury came back in under an hour, for all 100 people on 4 to 5 counts. They barely had time to even consider their names before they found everyone guilty on all counts, right? So they basically eliminated the leadership of the IWW. Some people, including some historians, have said essentially that repression killed the IWW in the USA. End of story. Right. We know that's not true, but you can actually make a very good argument that repression, if not kills, permanently weakens the IWW in the US. These same things were happening in other countries during World War I, most notably Wahhabis in Australia, who took a very principled anti-war stance and found that the Australian government, which was affiliated, of course, with the British Empire, were breaking state laws in Australia, right? Very similar. So more generally in many other countries, states don't take kindly to revolutionary unionists. And so there's repression in numerous other countries during and after the World War I era. Nevertheless, the Wahhabis persist. And actually, one of the things I really like about our book is that a number of chapters in it that focus on various different countries talk about the IWW in the 1920s and 1930s. They're supposedly dead, yet, here they are in Mexico, and here they are in Sweden,
right,
and here they are in New Zealand, and so here they are in Southern Africa. And so it's false, right? But it's especially false because it's people who are making these judgments are doing it solely based on the U.S. without ever considering that, in fact, let us also think about the IWW in other parts of the world.
Right. Well, we're going to get into specific continents and regions that the IWW spread to or influenced. But just before we get into it, we're gonna turn towards Africa and talk about Africa. But how did the IWW grow out? Like, how did that influence happen, either in like branches and union offices opening up in other countries and continents, but like, mm-hmm. how did it spread? Like, what caused yeah. that, and like, you know, what did it look like?
So just like in our times, radical people in radical organizations don't have lots of money. George Soros is not bankrolling, right? Anybody, let alone Wobblies, right? Like, right. And so, you know, it was volunteer organizers. What we would unpaid organizers. The IWW had no money. They also kept dues incredibly low and weren't always religious about, you know, collecting them. And so, you know, it was people who were believers. They are revolutionaries, right? Like, so Wobblies, you know, are become organizers, but it's not like they're paid organizers. But let's say you live in the UK and you are a Wobbly, and let's say you're sort of sick of the UK, but also you're a believer in spreading global revolution. Well, what do? No problem. You hop a ship to another part of the vast British Empire. And in the case of Southern Africa, we don't know, of course, the first person who was an IWW member in South Africa. It wasn't tweeted, right? But we can guess, right, that in the late part of the first decade of the 1900s or before 1910, there's already documentation of IWW chapters in South Africa by 1910. So like somewhere in the first few years, right, of IWW history, you know, some Wobblies sailed down to Cape Town, would have been the most likely port that they arrived in, the biggest port in Southern Africa on the Atlantic coast. And then, you know, did what they did in North America and other continents, right? Like, well, they find work, they start talking, they bring their literature with them, they sell them on the job, they organize on the job. And within a few years, like I said, around by 1910, there's already documented Wobbly chapters, small, but also Wobblies participating in and leading strikes of trolley or tram workers in Johannesburg, which was the biggest city in South Africa. It's in the interior. It's this big industrial mining complex. And so, you know, organizers, self-appointed, essentially, right? It's not like from Chicago they were sending Wobblies out to the four corners of the world. The Wobblies were never that organized, nor did they have the resources. It's individuals who take it upon themselves, because they're believers in the cause, right, who bring with, right? They bring with them their literature, right? Of course, often the Wobblies sang, and Joe Hill is a famous IWW member. Yeah, and so you also bring what was called the Little Red Songbook, this little book that you could fit in your pocket that had songs in it. And one of the best ways to educate people then and now is through music, because you can learn the words faster because there's a tune involved, right? And so, you know, by 1910, you've got Wobblies. There were other leftists in South Africa, but a number of them were quite racist. They believed in a white socialist, a white labor party, which seems to many of us contradictory, but nevertheless, there were people who legitimately could say socialism for white South Africans. There was a parallel movement in Australia where it was called white laborism, where in these, both of which are, you know, British, former British colonies, not coincidentally, where you have people who are avowedly socialist, yet are socialist only for fair-skinned European descended people, right? Like, wow.
This was nothing like some third positionist, like, quote, national socialist. I mean, these were people.
They were people who really were unionists, who really believed in, you know, the injustice of capitalism, but were also racist, right? And didn't believe that black workers, in the case of
just as long as Southern you do it to them, it's okay.
Right. Or Aborigines in Australia were essentially inferior peoples, right? I mean, racism's pervasive. It's worse, I'd say, in 1905 than it is in 2005. And so it's contradictory, I agree with you. It was not uncommon. But in the case of Southern Africa, there's also some anarchists around, not many, but a few. And a good friend and the author of a chapter in the book, Lucien van der Walt, who's himself of Afrikaner stock, we'll say. Afrikaners are people of Dutch descent, although he also has, like many white South Africans, some Anglo heritage. But Lucien has done a ton of research and writing on Wabwe's anarchists and other left radicals in Southern Africa, not just South Africa. And, you know, he is sort of the, I won't say only, but the leading scholar of Southern Africa Wabwe stuff. And so he writes a great chapter on IWW in South Africa. The last thing I'll say about that is that, you know, the Wabwe motto is legendary, an injury to one is an injury to all. And it's one of my favorite stories. We don't know when that motto got to South Africa, probably with the first Wabwe. But we know that after World War I in Cape Town, which at that time was the biggest port in South Africa, a strike broke out among dock workers who were a combination of Africans of different ethnic groups, but also people who were called locally coloreds, which we would in the U.S. call mixed race people, essentially blacks, but due to rape, right, there was some European blood in them too, right? And so coloreds and black Africans organized a strike under the banner of a new union called the Industrial and Commercial Workers Union, led by a man who's from Malawi, but who was living in Cape Town. And what's their motto? An injury to one is an injury to all, right? That union spreads across Southern Africa, not just what is South Africa, but what's now Namibia, Botswana, Zimbabwe, and Zambia, right, in the 1920s and 30s. And it organizes not as a union, but nevertheless as a radical organization of farm workers. It actually goes rural, which is very unusual. That is, though, most blacks in Southern Africa and Africa were rural still in that era. But they were, it's sort of quasi-anti-colonial, right? And they adopt much of the IWW preamble as well as the IWW motto. And if you fast forward to today, the largest labor federation in South Africa is called COSATU, the Congress of South African Trade Unions. And their motto is an injury to one is an injury to all, right? And so we don't know, like I said, who was that first Wab who comes ashore, right, in 1900-whatever. But we can see to this day, right, the tangible effect, right, of Wabwe throwing that proverbial pebble in the waters, and now we can see the ripples.
Wow, that's incredible. What was the name of that organization again that was influenced?
It was called the Industrial and Commercial Workers Union, the ICU. Anyone who studies unions starts talking in acronyms, which
right.
is unfortunate, but nevertheless not surprising, because, well, there's, you know, some unions are smart and name themselves like Unite, but most of us are stupid, and so we have these long names that,
right, like, well, when all the good names are taken, and right. this organization was explicitly syndicalist.
No, I wouldn't say that. I would say that they were very much shaped by the ideology of the IWW. But it takes different forms in different parts of Southern Africa in the 1920s and 1930s, but it spread and was the first large mass movement of blacks in the 20th century or prior to that, in the colonial era, right? And so it's for people who study Southern Africa, history, that is, of Southern Africa, this union is sort of well known, and its leader, this guy named Clemens Kadali, is sort of well known. There are books written about him, but, like, you know, most people don't connect IWW history to it. Lucien has, in particular, Lucien van der Waal, has done a great job of helping us connect those dots.
Is there anything else you want to add on the influence of the IWW within African labor struggles or any other struggles?
Not really. I mean, most of Africa in the early and mid 20th century are still colonized by various European peoples. Most Africans are still subsistence living. South Africa is the country to industrialize fastest because mm-hmm. of the gold diamonds that the British extracted billions of pounds worth out of, right? And so South Africa is unusual in its time and even today as being a larger and more economically developed economy than most other countries. And so, you know, the Wabwe's were a labor union. That means that in industrial or industrializing countries, we see it, but we don't see it in, I don't know, it's not like they're organizing in Kenya, in the early 1900s, or you know, what's now Chad, at least not to my knowledge. But you know, the economies were not yet industrial economies.
Right. Well, this next question comes from Twitter. Someone asked, can you expand on the role of South Asian anti-colonial revolutionaries within the IWW?
I can, thanks to my friend and contributor Tariq Khan, who wrote a wonderful chapter in our book about South Asian revolutionaries who were shaped by the IWW. So Tariq is a great budding historian. I mean, he's actually still working in his PhD. But so Ghadr is G-H-A-D-R in English, or G-A-D-R. In Urdu, I think, means mutiny. And so it was the name of an organization of South Asians, what now are the countries of India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh, but at that time was part of British India, who were in the diaspora of the British Empire, but beyond the British Empire, of Indians and anti-colonial, right, revolutionaries. And so some of these South Asians in global diaspora end up in the Pacific Northwest in the early 1900s, including some of the leaders of Ghadr, including a man named Heyerdahl. And so some of these guys are actually quite smart and educated, not necessarily grunts, workers, but are treated as such in the United States because, well, they're brown, right? And so there's this story that Tariq tells about in his chapter where Heyerdahl gets a job. He's actually working, or he's trying to go to school in Oregon or Washington, but he needs some money, and so he gets a job working, or tries to get a job working in a forest, working as a timber worker. But at first, his employer doesn't want to hire him because of his appearance. But a wobbly organizer basically pressures this boss to hire. And then this guy finds himself in his camp, and some of the people in his camp are wobblies. And so he becomes a wobbly because he's recruited into the organization. But this organization, even before his membership in it, had demonstrated, opposition to prejudice of color and race, we'll say. And so this guy was part of this organization that organized not just North America, but across the globe, fighting British imperialism, right? But because of the IWW, as well as some other influences, they're very anarchistic. And so they're not interested in the formation of an Indian nation state. And so today in India, right, if you study Indian history, supposedly, you learn about the rise of a nation in the same way in the USA you learn about the American Revolution. They learn about Gandhi and Nehru as sort of revolutionary leaders, but they're nationalist leaders, right? Ghadr doesn't fit into that narrative. And so Ghadr, this early 20th century anti-colonial movement, doesn't fit, right? And they don't fit because they're anarchistic, because of this wobbly. So their goal was not necessarily forming an Indian nation in the way that ultimately occurred after World War II in the late 1940s, right? And so it's thanks to this sort of experience, right, that this individual had, that then he brought and continued to sort of meet and organize with socialists and anarchists and wobblies. He lived in the USA for a number of more years into the 19-teens, right? And so that's a little taste. So the wobblies weren't organizing in the South Asian subcontinent, per se. They're organizing in the South Asian diaspora, right, in North America, Canada, and California, right, and the Pacific Northwest, as Tariq Khan's chapter is about.
Let's talk about some other places. Tell us some other interesting stories or anything else from the book, starting with places kind of outside of Europe and the West.
Mm. Sure. Well, I mean, I understand your sort of interest in understanding a global resistance to capitalism, since capitalism is global. It is worth noting that, you know, the majority of wobbly organizing was in North America and Europe, but also in Australia, New Zealand, countries that were more economically developed, as well as across much of Latin America. But I'll tell you a few stories, because there are many great ones. So one of our contributors is a New Zealander named Mark Derby, and Mark reads, he's not Maori, but he reads Maori. And so in the early 1900s, Maori being the indigenous population and language of the peoples of what's now New Zealand, another part of the British Empire. And so, you know, some Wobblies took it upon themselves, one in particular, to learn Maori and then trying to organize Maori workers. Maoris were, some Maoris worked in the mines, some Maori worked in agriculture, as well, including like wool processing, raising of sheep. We think of New Zealand, we might think of sheep, right? Wool was a major industry, not just there, but New Zealand in particular. Some of the people were Maoris, right? Well, are we going to leave them unorganized? Are we going to leave them so that then if we go on strike that the Maoris are going to be scabbing on us? No, that would be stupid. And so the Wobblies, you know, in their New Zealand publications had Maori language articles where they tried to basically explain why essentially socialism would be attractive to Maoris and why they should become members of the IWW, with some success in, you know, the early, the pre-World War I era is when I'm referring to. And so that's amazing, right? Like, it's actually, to my knowledge, the best example of appealing to indigenous workers. Another good story is, you know, the life of Tom Barker. An Australian woman named Paula De Angelis wrote about Tom Barker. So Tom Barker was English, but he ended up, like many folks from the UK did, in New Zealand, right, where he becomes an activist. He first learns about the Wobblies. He's kicked out of New Zealand. He ends up in Australia, where he organizes. It's very common in this era. It's actually pretty cheap and easy for people to move by ship globally. You know, Barker ends up in Australia. He's a leading organizer of the IWW during the World War I era. They're very anti-war. They suffer repression. Barker's actually expelled from Australia. He ends up in Chile, the port city's Valparaiso, where he's taken in by dock workers who are very sympathetic to him. And actually, Chile has had the largest membership of IWW in South America in the 19-teens and 20s, although he only spends a bit of time in Chile before he then goes around the Horn and ends up in Buenos Aires, the big port in Argentina, where he organizes sailors and dock workers for several years in Argentina. He, like a number of other Wobblies, is attracted to the Soviet Union because, well, it was the first successful socialist revolution in the world. It's not surprising. He ends up going, like hundreds of other Wobblies do, to the Soviet Union, where he tries to build a socialist state. And he supposedly never joined the Communist Party, but lived in the Soviet Union for some years before he was moved to New York City, where he organized, like in, I forget, in the 20s and into the 30s, on behalf of the Soviet Union to essentially recruit and support the cause internationally before moving back to England, right, where he then spent his final few decades. And so you've got this globetrotting, right, radical, who really sort of explores multiple different socialist traditions, which is not uncommon. You know, so Paula De Angelis raised this great short chapter that sort of focuses on, some of our chapters focus on individuals, right? So they're biographical vignettes, you might say. But Tom Barker's story is a great one.
Awesome. Well, that's really interesting. What was the name of that publication in New Zealand again?
I don't know if I told you what the name of it was, I actually don't remember. I'd have to look it up in the chapter, like what the name of the IWW New Zealand. The Wobblies, like many an organization, they, again, weren't centralized. I mean, even in the USA, the IWW at different times had more than a dozen different publications in multiple different languages.
Yeah.
Right. So in New Zealand, I don't know, but I would suspect they had one, maybe two publications. And for a while, its publication in New Zealand was publishing some of its articles, right, in Maori. But, you know, here's the plug, right? In our book, Wobblies of the World, you know, you can read a chapter on Derby doing New Zealand, as well as another colleague, Peter Clayworth, who writes about a man who's New Zealander but who lives in the USA, where he encounters the Wobblies and then ends up moving back to New Zealand, where he helps to organize Wobbly mine workers back in his home country.
Wow, that's fascinating. Well, this is a question that's long interest me, but speaking about Wobblies in the U.S., can we talk a little bit about members of the IWW that went to fight in either the Mexican Revolution, but also the Spanish Civil War and Revolution? I was curious if you could talk a little bit about that.
So Dave Struthers, one of the co-editors, but also contributes a chapter based on his forthcoming personal book, right, writes a lot about Southern California and how in L.A., Anglo-Americans and Mexicans and Mexican-Americans are crisscrossing, you know, Southern California, Arizona, into the mining copper belt, into northern Mexico. And although his part of his chapter in our book doesn't focus on it, famously in 1910-11, during the early days of the Mexican Revolution, several hundred Wobblies and fellow travelers, will say, participate in what was nicknamed the Baja Revolution, right, when they go down into the Baja Peninsula south of Tijuana, right, south of San Diego, and join that struggle. I don't know what the documentation is, but, you know, there were rumors also that Joe Hill was part of that. We do have a chapter, however, a great chapter by a man named Matt White, who wrote on Wobblies who fought in Spain in the Spanish Civil War in the mid-late 1930s. In what were called the International Brigades, when anti-fascists volunteered and traveled to Spain to fight on behalf of the socialist government, which was at risk of being overthrown by the fascist, and ultimately were. And so Matt does this chapter, does great research, where, you know, there are no Wobbly brigades. And so dozens of Wobblies, including many who are leading organizers among dock workers and sailors, especially in Philadelphia, which at that time was still a significant port, although now it is not, where they fought in the communist brigades, right? They want to fight on behalf of Spain. They want to fight on behalf of the cause. There's no IWW brigade. So, okay, just like Orwell, you know, went from England and fought in the communist brigades for a while before becoming uncomfortable with that. So did Wobblies, right? The funny thing in the chapter is that, you know, surprise, surprise, the Wobblies don't get along with the communists. The Wobblies want a much more democratic, horizontal army, and the communists are much more comfortable with top-down bureaucracy and authority, and so are frustrated by Wobblies who, you know, want to actually talk about the orders instead of just being ordered around, right? Some of these Wobblies end up in prison, actually. And a number of them also are killed or wounded in Spain as they're fighting against the fascists. And Matt also argues that that really hurt, actually, the IWW and amongst sailors, but not just in Philadelphia, but, you know, on the Atlantic seaboard, because actually there's a lot of organizing happening among sailors in the 30s in North America and the world. But in a way, it was a unfortunate outcome. It was noble, perhaps, that, you know, dozens of Wobblies want to go to Spain to fight, but it had the longer-term effect that it really undermined potential opportunities that these really energetic organizers could have created had they either remained in North America or come back alive, right? But Matt White's chapter is a really brilliant one on Wobblies in the Spanish Civil War.
Thanks for coming on. How can people get the book, and how can people follow your work?
Oh, well, it would be wonderful if people interested in these subjects got a copy of Wobblies of the World. It's published by Pluto Press, which is a London-based publishing company, but, you know, you can find Pluto Press online. You can purchase it in other ways. I always encourage people to encourage their library to purchase a copy as the best possible way. That way, more than one person can read it and share it. You know, and Kenyon, who lives in Texas, and I, who live in Illinois, and Dave, who lives in Copenhagen, but our contributors who live in actually half a dozen other countries, we're very happy to organize events. So if anyone's listening and wants, in fact, to create an event with one or maybe several of us, it's possible, right? Our goal is to spread the word, and we're very happy to do it. We've done events in New York City and Chicago this month of November and October, and later this month in New Zealand, in Auckland, there's going to be the next two. A couple of us are going to be in Belfast in April. But, you know, we're thrilled to sort of talk about the book to anyone who's interested in listening. And yeah, but PlutoBooks.com is the publisher's website, and Pluto is a good radical publisher. And so instead of buying it from bad corporations, right, it's you could easily purchase it directly from you know, the press that we worked with.
Awesome. Hey, thanks so much for coming on and for spending so much time bringing these histories to light. It's great.
Oh, you know, it's my pleasure. I deeply respect the work that It's Going Down does and has done. And it's an honor, right, to sort of spend time talking with you. I appreciate the questions.
Thanks so much. Have a good one.
You too.
This is the final moment of the beginning of our lives. Watching the stars above the Barcelona sky, we wait for dawn with revolution in our eyes. When we'll face the men that Franco sent to die. Oh, that's it.